today. Donald Trump has revealed that negotiations are underway to secure a location for a new summit with Kim Jong-un. We ask what 2019 has in store for the North Korean leader. And, in opinion, The Guardian film editor Catherine Shord on why the movies that win big during the award season may not be the best ones. Today is North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's birthday. At least, we think it is.
We're not even sure that this actually is his birthday. We just know that this is the day that he celebrates it. And we know that because Dennis Rodman was recorded, of course, singing happy birthday to him at one of his previous parties.
Happy birthday to you.
Dennis Rodman, the basketball player. This year could bring opportunity for Kim Jong-un, as he hopes for another meeting with the US president and to present a more modern image of North Korea. But those who have managed to visit say it remains a deeply repressive society.
It almost felt like someone had taken 1984 and read it as a manual of how to set up an authoritarian state.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what can we expect from Kim Jong-un and North Korea in 2019?
I think this year, Kim Jong-un has quite a lot to celebrate.
Tanya Brannigan is a Guardian leader writer and former China correspondent. She spent a lot of time trying to understand the politics of North Korea.
He's had a very successful year from his point of view. Trump gave him a huge win with the Singapore summit. So although the situation's certainly still fairly precarious, I think he could feel that he's had a very successful year. And most people would say it's astonishing, really, how much the US has given him.
And what do we know about him?
Well, we know he's a very young man.
How young?
Around 35. So when he took over, he was not yet 30.
Today, Kim Jong-il's son and heir choked back what appeared to be real tears as he gave a solemn bow of goodbye.
He is truly not a ready-for-primetime player. The Chinese themselves are a little worried about whether he's really up to the task.
There was a lot of concern precisely because of that inexperience and because he hadn't had the sort of the long apprenticeship that his father had served, really, at his grandfather's side. The concern was that he was very young, that he didn't have that experience, and also just a sense that it was really hard to know much about him. I mean, we know that he studied in Switzerland. We know that he's fond of basketball. And over sort of recent years, we've seen that he's obviously trying to modernise his country to some degree, that he wants, for the elite at least, a sort of more modern looking, perhaps slightly more glamorous, if you could put it that way, North Korea. And so compared to how it was sort of 10 years ago, there really has been quite a marked transition.
What about the people of North Korea? Around the world, the country causes a huge amount of outrage, but it's always seemed that the leaders have been worshipped from inside. I mean, is that true? And has it changed at all under the leadership of Kim Jong-un?
What we've seen is this sort of diminution over the generations. And so although it's obviously felt that the Kim family brand, in a sense, is extremely important to the regime, at the same time, it's clearly much, much less potent than it was. So I think that the real veneration that there was for Kim Il-sung just sort of doesn't really exist in the same way anymore. And at the same time, because the state has really sort of almost fallen out of the industrialized world, so there was a point where North Korea was actually doing better economically than China or South Korea, sort of back in the 60s, thanks to the support of the Soviet Union. And what we saw is that it really sort of went backwards, that we saw this devastating famine in which hundreds of thousands died in the 90s. We saw really the collapse of all the things that the state had provided. And so what people see now is a state that just gets in the way, that's an obstacle to the things that they want, to the extent that people will pay bribes not to go to their state-assigned job, because the money they make is so small that they just can't survive on it. They can do better in the black market. So they go off and trade, and they take some of that cash and they give it to their boss as a bribe so they don't have to turn up to their job. Now, that's kind of extraordinary.
It's incredibly difficult for journalists to find out what's happening in North Korea. The state controls any official messaging. Some information has trickled across the border with China, in person or through mobile phones using Chinese SIM cards. Defectors have also spoken out, but many fear this can lead to serious repercussions for their families. Reporters can only really get into the country if they are accepted onto an organised trip chaperoned by local guides. Guardian and Observer journalist Emma Graham Harrison had that chance in 2018.
There's not that many trips to North Korea. It's very hard for journalists to get in there, to get visas. And you accept conditions there as a reporter that you wouldn't really accept anywhere else at all. You have almost no control over your itinerary, over who you meet. And there's almost no other country in the world where you would say, OK, yeah, I'll do that. But that's the only way to see anything of North Korea.
Did you get a sense of what it was like to live in the country?
So one of the things that I found really eerie about being there, of course, I thought it would be vaguely like 1984. It's a sort of, you know, become a sort of byword for authoritarian government. But it almost felt like someone had taken 1984 and read it as a manual of how to set up an authoritarian state. Down to the pictures of the dear leader. I mean, in this case, there are three dear leaders, the Kim dynasty, the grandfather, Kim Il-sung, the son, Kim Jong-il, and the current leader, Kim Jong-un. There were no national heroes. There were no streets named after anyone else, no statues of anyone else, no one else you could pick out in the pictures. It was just the three Kims, and then everybody else was an anonymous mass kind of glorifying them.
Did you ever manage to get away from your guides?
To my surprise, I mean, I always sort of operate on the basis if you don't ask, you won't know. And I asked my the guys who were showing us around who hated being called minders, they were both kind of minders, translators and all of that, if I could go for a run in the morning. And they said yes. They said stay beside the river, but beyond that, they didn't really give me any instructions. I mean, perhaps they saw how unfit I was, so they figured I wouldn't get very far.
What did you see on your runs?
I saw a lot of people who pretended not to see me. I mean, I was a pretty unusual sight. People are expected to wear muted colours. Women don't really wear trousers until they are sort of older, maybe in their 50s. It's a country where dress codes are so strict, you're not even meant to wear jewellery. So there's women who stand at the entrance of every apartment block, appointed by the state, who check that people who are leaving in the morning are dressed appropriately, and if they're not, they send them back up to their flat to change their clothes. So I went out running almost every morning. People were going to work mostly on bicycles or walking. People walk a lot more than they do here. All of them wearing, they all have to wear badges of Kim Il-sung, or they can have sort of various combinations of the Kim family, but they have to wear these little badges. That's the only jewellery you're officially expected to wear. So in sort of muted suits, and they all just walk past me as if I wasn't there. And it was sort of, you know, I was huffing and puffing and red in the face. And it was really, for me, that was one of the things that was most telling about how tightly controlled that society is, that even overtly admitting that you've seen something that looks out of place could be a risky thing to do, that it's better just to ignore something strange because it's only likely to bring trouble. At least that was the conclusion I drew.
Is it a beautiful city?
Pyongyang was largely flattened by American bombing in the Second World War. I think it's important to remember that. So there's 95% of it, I think, was destroyed. There's very little left of historic Pyongyang. And the sort of, you know, Soviet-inspired North Korean style is pretty, you know, pretty brutalist kind of concrete apartment blocks. But one thing they have done, I don't know if it's because, you know, it's really cold in winter, so there's long sort of stretches of sort of quite dark, you know, sort of cold months with snow and not much greenery. They do paint the apartment blocks. You can see these crazy shades of pastel colours. So you're driving down the main streets and there's sort of a pink one, a green one, an orange one, a yellow one, and it feels very at odds with the sort of ruling system, this authoritarian state painting their buildings these sort of shades of pastel.
Did you get enough of a sense? Did you get to meet enough people to know whether or not people were happy?
I think, you know, people's lives are incredibly constrained there in a way that I think it's almost impossible for us to imagine. But we went to a park where There was a group of old people who said they were retired, they worked in factories, and they were having a barbecue. They brought traditional Korean costumes and they were all dancing together. And it seemed genuine to me. I mean, there is always the worry in North Korea, has this all been set up? Have these people been told to come here and picnic so that we can find them? But it was a busy park. It was also full of people taking wedding pictures. And we chose to go and talk to those people. So they would have had to recruit a lot of extras for, you know, the hundreds of people to know that we would chance on the ones they want us to speak to. So the flip side of that is that Pyongyang itself is almost like a showcase city. It's only kind of the elite who get to live there. So it's sort of the luckiest North Koreans. And then the experts I spoke to said maybe 10% of North Koreans can have a sort of very modestly enjoyable life. You know, everyone else is you know, the elite is about 10%, and everyone else has a pretty tough time of it on a day-to-day basis.
완전한 비핵화로 나가려는 것은 우리 당과 공화국 정부의 불변한 입장이며 나의 확고한 의지입니다.
So Tania, last week Kim Jong-un released his New Year message. What did we hear and what did we see?
Well, even visually, it was quite a contrast with previous speeches. So instead of seeing him standing up at a podium, we had him in this big, rather stately room, overseen, of course, by pictures of his grandfather and father. And he's wearing this Western suit, he's sitting in this leather armchair. And the impression you have is really much more of a leader who is sort of part of the international realm, somebody who's been out there, has met a US president, is in this world and is really addressing a message as much to that outside international community as he is to his own country people.
And what did he say?
So Kim Jong-un in this speech has said, look, I'm always ready to sit down with the US president again. Well, that's not surprising, we knew that. But he says, if the US miscalculates our patience, if it forces us down this path, if it puts pressure upon us, then we've really got no option but to explore a new way. It's really a microcosm of everything that's happened over the last year. So last year, with tensions at a high, he made this very chilling statement about a nuclear button on my desk. But at the same time, of course, he was indicating that he was interested in a rapprochement. He made this overture on the Winter Olympics in Seoul. And of course, that's what sort of helped to pave the way towards North Korea's participation. And that led, of course, to the Singapore meeting with Donald Trump himself.
7:35 in the morning, if you're just waking up, we're continuing our breaking coverage ahead of the meeting between President Trump and Kim Jong-un in Singapore. Security measures are at an all-time high.
President Trump and Kim Jong-un are right here in the same city. Their hotels are now less than a half mile apart.
On the agenda, of course, North Korea's nuclear arsenal, and the Trump White House has been both raising hopes and lowering expectations about what will be accomplished here in the coming hours.
They met one-to-one. And one of the most alarming things, perhaps, is that Trump told people afterwards, so, you know, don't worry about the notes because I've got a great memory, so it will all be fine. I mean, I think that's a pretty terrifying prospect in itself.
Well, I don't have to verify because I have one of the great memories of all time. So I don't have to.
As to how meaningful the discussions were, well, you know, we know they came out with a statement at the end of it, but it was pretty weak stuff. And then Trump was sort of up and praising Kim Jong-un for running his country tough, which is quite the euphemism for some of the atrocities that the UN reports have described.
Well, he is very talented. Anybody that takes over a situation like he did at 26 years of age and is able to run it and run it tough.
Really, it seemed as if sort of Trump was under this impression that North Korea had kind of committed to denuclearization. Well, it's when it talks about sort of denuclearization, what North Korea means is something that is gradual, that's staged, and above all is reciprocal. It's not saying, you know, let's chuck out our nukes tomorrow. And what the US is still sort of talking about is, well, it's got to be verifiable, you know, it's got to be final. They're talking about North Korea getting rid of their weapons of mass destruction. Remember that this is a country which was flattened by US bombs in the Korean War in the 50s. And it's seen what's happened around the world, saw what happened in Iraq, and it also saw what happened in Libya. And I think the lessons it really took from that is that you get weapons of mass destruction and you hang on to weapons of mass destruction. what we've seen is that they've come out of 2018 with a summit with the US president, which in itself was this extraordinary coup for them. They gave nothing. They made no concessions to win that. And they were treated as if they were the equal on the world stage of the United States. I mean, I think the other key point is that South Korea put in a huge amount of work here in making this possible and in trying to calm things. I mean, South Korea is in a very unenviable position because, of course, they're sort of the most vulnerable point in all of this. And the Moon Jae-in administration really had sought from the first to reach out to the North, but also really sought to reach out to the US, were offering quite extraordinary flattery if Donald Trump persuaded him that this was a good idea to sort of get to the table. And I think South Korea were really sort of the critical players in all of this.
Does the New Year message tell us anything about what to expect from the relationship between the US and North Korea?
I think what this really tells us as we enter 2019 is that this is a worrying year. We're in a better place, obviously, than when tensions were at the height and the US was talking about potential military action. But the gap between the North Korean and US positions is increasingly obvious. Now, Trump, when he came back from Singapore, hilariously said, there's no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea, as if he'd sort of fixed the dispute with one meeting. We knew that wasn't the case. And we've seen that the problem is that there's been no real progress because it's very hard to close the gap between where they are. We have sort of seen some gestures from the North, for example, blowing up parts of a nuclear test site, halting missile tests and so forth. These are not things that are irreversible. Now, it may be that they all kind of keep kicking the can down the road. North Korea kind of quietly gets on with the nuclear sort of work it wishes to, but without having any of the sort of the attention-grabbing tests and so forth that might cause it problems, and the US stays on side. The risk, of course, is that Trump at some point is convinced by the people around him that he's been cheated, or that he needs a distraction, or simply there's some sort of misunderstanding or sort of misstep or misjudgment. There's lots to be concerned about, I think.
So Trump said over the weekend that he and Kim Jong-un are negotiating a location for a second meeting. How likely is that to happen in 2019?
I think that really depends on Donald Trump's vanity, doesn't it? We've seen that he's been flattered in the first place into this meeting, which everybody regarded as highly unwise. Will Kim Jong-un be able to tempt him back? We'll just have to see.
You can read more of Tanya and Emma's work at theguardian.com. Coming up, should you rush out to watch the winning films at the Golden Globes? Now, Guardian film editor Catherine Shored on what's really going on at the Golden Globes.
I think one should approach watching these sort of award ceremonies with extreme caution, because essentially it's a massively PR-managed stage show, and it's just people campaigning for a bigger prize.
Women, we're nurturers. That's what's expected of us. We have our children, we have our husbands, if we're lucky enough, and our partners, whoever. But we have to find personal fulfillment. We have to fill our, follow our dreams.
I don't think any of these ceremonies are really about what's a good film. It's really not about quality. It's really about something else now. And that's a bit sad, but they can work as great entertainment in their own rights. They can work to occasionally surface films that people might not go and see and might now, like something like The Favourite, which is really drawing people in. And if it weren't for all these incredible speeches that Olivia Colman is giving, it probably wouldn't.
And I would like to tell you how much this film means to me, but I can't think of it, and because I'm too excited.
I think the PR campaign means that it is very, very difficult now for smaller films to get not just the acclaim but the exposure and go on to win big prizes. It's just very, very difficult. Roma would seem to be an exception to that, but nothing else is getting a look in. The thing one has to remember about the Golden Globes is that they're voted for by a very small group of people whose taste is quite questionable. It's 90 international entertainment journalists who haven't necessarily done incredible work themselves, who happen to live in LA, whose identities are strangely mysterious, and who have a history of being corrupted by heavy gift giving from the studios, which has been sort of clamped down on now. Oh yeah, it's a pretty dodgy setup. Whereas the BAFTAs are voted for by around 5,000 fairly sort of trusted members of the industry, and the Oscars by about 7,000 similar. And these people have sort of got to have attained a certain level of respectability in their craft. There's a wider spread of them, and they have achieved success in their field, which suggests they have a higher level of discretion. However, they are also part of an industry, and so they are interested in furthering the industry in which they work. That may mean freezing out people with whom they've worked that they don't like. That may mean freezing out people with whom they've worked who they don't think will employ them personally. It means they come with a lot of baggage. It's an entirely partial environment, and watching a work do attended by very glamorous people who may or may not say interesting things is fun, but it's that. It's not an indicator of a good film.
That's it for today. This episode was produced by Rachel Humphreys and India Rackerson. Sound design was by Axel Cocutier. The executives were Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. See you tomorrow.